ago, and now herpes-infected monkeys are terrorizing the state. I mean, I can think of a number of reasons to not visit Florida. I really can. But just that headline, herpes-infected monkeys terrorize Florida. And the article doesn't really say if they're mouth herpes, finger herpes, or I guess do monkeys have fingers? They just don't have the opposable thumb.
Yeah, they're phalanges.
Or, you know, good old-fashioned genital herpes.
Monkeys love their genitals.
But who? I mean, all mammals love their genitals. We're just required by law to wear pants in public so we don't display ourselves the same way that other animals do. All mammals love their genitals. Yeah, brain amoebas found in water supply where boy died in Louisiana. In the water supply. You know, when there was a big scare of people using their neti pots. Neti pots are little pots to irrigate your sinuses. It's part of Ayurvedic medicine, which is traditionalist Indian non-chemical medicine. And you literally pour salt water into your nose and irrigate your sinuses. And there was a big scare of people doing that because brain-eating amoebas were starting to infect people. A couple people died. That's because they were using their good old-fashioned tap water to do so. Which is a little creepy. Or toilet water. I don't know. I don't know how you go about getting a brain-eating amoeba from using your neti pot, because I haven't gotten one yet. Man. Spontaneous Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. I mean, there's issues taking place here. Prions eating holes inside of your brain. You thought it was bad enough when people started getting AIDS from colonoscopy equipment at the Veterans Administration. No, it gets a lot worse. These people getting these diseases, this isn't even coming from the VA either. These are non-government hospitals.
Pretty dirty places anyway.
Or the flesh-eating MRSA infections that you can get from hospitals. Hospitals seem really clean, but they're not.
No.
Just by the very nature of what it is. Stay out of hospitals at all costs, please. There's also a good news cycle for officer-involved shootings. You see the crazy guy on Broadway and Times Square in New York?
Yeah, I've started to notice that the mentally ill are being hunted, apparently, specifically by police.
Well, they're easy targets.
Right, and they act crazy, which is
the... But this guy wasn't that easy of a target, apparently. So a crazy guy enters into busy street in lower Manhattan, or midtown Manhattan, I don't know. I'm not that familiar with that island. Anyway, some part of Manhattan. Crazy guy enters inner street, starts to create traffic problems. Police respond, try to catch crazy man. Crazy man puts hand in pocket to simulate pulling out weapon. Crazy man gets shot. They don't even shoot the crazy man. They try to tase him. Three shots ring out. Not a single one hits crazy man. Two of the shots hit innocent bystanders. That's really the kind of the concerning part.
Who were incidentally crazy as well?
No, they didn't say anything about whether or not they were crazy. In the article I read, Jake.
It is Manhattan, though.
They were tourists. But that the cops would start shooting, the New York PD, NYPD, would start shooting at folks. Or at a folk. And not hit him, but hit people innocently bystanding. I'm beginning to think if you're going to start discharging your weapon in public, you might want to have a good, I don't know, bead on your suspect. And shoot the right guy. Because that just kind of makes you look a little foolish, doesn't it? A little not good at your job. And then in North Carolina, a guy who ran his car off the road and into a ditch and had to climb out the back window of his car, who I believe was a black man, was pounding on somebody's door at 2:30 in the morning asking for help. The lady answered the door thinking it was her husband, which apparently is normal for him. When she realized it wasn't her husband, she called the cops. When the cops showed up, the guy started to approach the cops quickly. The report I read said he was running towards the cops, probably because he was all freaked out after having been in a car accident. I was hoping for somebody to help him. And the cops tried to tase him, and the taser didn't work, so they shot him and killed him. Only after that did they realize that, oh my God, this guy was in a car accident. But the story I read said that the cop that did the shooting has already been charged with voluntarily volunteered for the manslaughter. So another common thing to happen in the last news cycle is for cops to shoot at people. And even in the Northland, Jake, did you see there was a double homicide?
Yep.
Did you hear the double homicide?
I heard something.
Now, there was a double homicide, and then a woman with non-life-threatening injuries stuck in the apartment. And Clay County prosecutors have decided not to charge a man with shooting a carjacker on his property. A lot of shootings going on. There was a small flash mob on the plaza last night for the Floyd Mayweather fight.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't hear about that one.
Just a medium-sized flash mob. They just had to deploy a little bit of the pepper spray. Not a whole bunch. Just a small amount.
What were they mobbing?
Oh, it was Saturday, man. They were just celebrating. I saw this report, and I thought it was kind of funny. I didn't even read the article, but I just liked the headline. Special report. White House full of vermin.
The end. That was the whole article.
That was the whole article. Just choose whatever type of vermin you'd like to have.
Well, D.C. in general is kind of an icky place also. I mean, anytime you concrete over swamplands,
you're going to have, at the very least, a mosquito problem.
Yeah, vermin in general.
I still think the best headline of the week was herpes-infected monkeys terrorize Florida. And did you see the good news?
Anthony Weiner lost?
That they failed to erect Weiner?
Is he done yet?
I don't, you know, it's funny how I don't care.
At least they should have a special election to take his cell phone away.
But the girl he was sending pictures to as Carlos Danger, her name is Sydney Leathers. I mean, that's her real name. They don't even have to change her name now that she's going to be a porn star.
Perfect.
And she will be a porn star as soon as they restart filming porn. Because there's been a lot of AIDS in the porn industry lately.
That's what I heard.
Sydney Leathers. I mean, you know, good for her. It's a good career move for her.
Maybe Mr. Wiener could just star alongside her. He might have to change his name, though, like Tony Baloney or something.
You don't think Tony Wiener would work?
No, Anthony Wiener's probably already copyrighted and trademarked.
I think that would be a beautiful name for him.
Tony Baloney?
10 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock in the morning. No, but the good news is that sea ice has increased. More so this year than in any year. And back, apparently, sea ice levels for the people who are watching and following this are back up to 2002 levels.
Is Al Gore okay?
Oh, yeah, he's doing great. He sold his network to the country of Dubai for an amazing profit. So he's doing wonderful. He's got a lot of money to fill up his jet with that high octane fuel. He's just jet setting around. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with you in a few moments right here on the Paragon Radio Program. 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI.
Hi, I'm Jan Brill, a volunteer here at KKFI for the Heartland Labor Forum, asking you to join me in support of Free Range Radio. Unlike ad-driven commercial radio, KKFI's DJs and hosts explore music and issues that get short shrift in the mainstream media. They're free rangers, willing to play music that's not top 40 or report on stories with a news cycle longer than a day. Getting it right always takes precedence over getting it first on KKFI. KKFI has been free range for more than a quarter of a century. Through thick and thin, KKFI has been there for you, celebrating our vibrant local music scene, giving voice to the voiceless, going where the silence is, unafraid to color outside the lines. KKFI provides you with news, blues, and views, whether you listen in your shower, your car, or stream online in your cubicle. KKFI, the region's home for free-range radio, deserves your support. Thanks.
The confusing debate over Syria and on-again, off-again U.S. military strikes leaves out a lot, like the work of nonviolent activists inside the country. Journalist Rania Kalik joins Counterspin to talk about that and some of what they have to say about the debate over U.S. bombing. Now on Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m., right after Mic Check.
Yay. 816-9315534-931-KKFI is the telephone number on the 16th day of September 2013. You're listening to the Paragon Radio Program. I'm Benjamin, your host of the show. And as of right now, there are no herpes-infested monkeys ravaging Kansas City. Thank God, right? You can only imagine how terrible that would be. There is infestations of all types, though, out there in the metro. But right now, everything is relatively quiet, even though the club on 39th and Main is open tonight. But hey, it's a rainy night, so there's nothing going on. You know, when the flash mobs of last night have dissipated, the gun violence continues to be a big issue for the metro. I think there's going to be something taking place. What is that going to be? Some sort of Midwest Voices type thing. What is this event coming to Kansas City? Urban Crime Summit. It'll be convening today at UMKC. I look forward to that. The Urban Crime Summit. Hopefully it will be free of violence. UMKC generally is. Even though last year there was a off-campus shooting of a couple of students after a botched drug deal. A very rare homicide in the 64130 zip code. Don't have a lot of that in 64130. But nevertheless, the Urban Crime Summit. Over the next 4 days, some of the nation's leading criminal justice experts will join law enforcement leaders and community activists in Kansas City and in St. Louis to discuss ways to loosen the grip crime and gun violence have on the state's largest urban centers. The Attorney General, Chris Koster, said the goal of the first Urban Crime Summit is to examine the best practices to reduce crime in both cities and devise a list of recommendations that would help state legislators create new laws. Right. It's clearly what we need to combat violence and crime in the inner cities of the United States is more laws. Right. If only there was a greater deterrent against people committing crimes. Maybe we need stiffer penalties for drug sentences.
No. I think
is that your platform?
That's my nope is my new platform. Yeah, I mean, lots of stuff's been illegal the whole time. It seems to be a non-deterrent.
Too much time has passed since the state government has really tried to explore the issues surrounding urban crime in these two metro areas, said the Attorney General. Too frequently, the Missouri legislature is seen as not focusing on these types of issues, and Jeff City is painted as an entity that spends more time on rural issues. So, New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly will be here. Kansas City Police Chief Daryl Forte. Mayor Sylvester James. Attorney, U.S. Attorney Tammy Dickinson and Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker are all scheduled to be here this week, or the out-of-town folks are, to speak at 9:45 a.m. today on how New York City has reduced crime. Other summit topics include gang violence, crime mapping, hotspot policing, mental health, crime-fighting technology, strategies to reduce gun violence, and challenges facing felons when re-entering society. I mean, that is a real thing. I mean, if you went to prison, you get out of prison. I mean, people who have never been to prison before are struggling to find work. People who have gone to college and gotten degrees and have never been incarcerated are having issues finding work. I can imagine that only is magnified by people who have been recently released from prison. And the curious tale of, what was this gentleman's name? I'll have to look it up.
Benjamin Buttons?
No, not Benjamin Buttons. Let's see if I can actually, if the Star's website will actually let me search something on it. And here we go. Calla D. Johnson. Calla D. Johnson is serving a 20-year sentence in federal prison for trafficking in cocaine. Calla D. Johnson, Calla D., is the individual who has just been recently charged with the murder of Deanna L. Lieber, who was an attorney for the state of Kansas. I'm exactly sure what her role was with the state of Kansas. She was an attorney. She worked for the state of Kansas. She lived in Lawrence, and she had been to Starlight. I think this was 4 years ago, July of 2009. She had been to Starlight one night, and she was hit by a stray bullet on 59th and US 71, Bruce R. Watkins Drive, because Calla D. Johnson was acting all gangster, and he had been out of prison for about 9 months, and he was on parole. And he was back to his old ways of apparently selling drugs and threatening people with firearms. And his intended target was not Deanna Lieber, because, of course, he didn't know her, and she was just passing through on the highway. But as he was crossing 71 on 59th Street and shooting at another car, his aim was like that of the NYPD, and he shot an innocent drive stander. She wasn't standing by. It's hard to say how that would be. She was in her vehicle, and her vehicle, I believe, was moving.
Passerby. An innocent passerby.
She got shot. And it's kind of interesting because they were able to determine that it was this guy that did that because they had red light camera photos of the vehicle.
Uh-oh.
This is, of course, before the city of Kansas City purchased their shot spotting technology. So they would know exactly where bullets had been discharged from weapons. But it's funny. I think that the Urban Crime Summit being hosted here on the campus of UMKC, and they're simultaneously being something convened in St. Louis, will offer absolutely nothing in the way of solutions whatsoever to the problem of urban crime and violence, because there is no way to solve the problem through more legislation. I think you would be best served by removing legislation.
Right, like recalling some of these drug laws that, you know, are the root of incarceration and, you know, quote unquote crime on the outside.
I think that would probably be the most effective way. You're not going to ever be able to eradicate the economics of illegal drugs if their economics are so powerful. And that's really the key here. Is that for a lot of folks, that becomes, you really have no future for so much of America's inner city denizen. You have no future whatsoever. Where you can either sell drugs, go to jail, or catch bullets. And that's what truly fundamentally needs to be addressed, but I don't think the Crime Summit will do so. I'm pretty sure that New York was able to lower its violent crime by gentrifying large parts of what had been high crime areas. And by gentrifying, I mean forcing the po folks out.
Putting them on a bus.
or as the state of Nevada did over the last couple of years. The state of Nevada put 1,500 mentally ill patients on Greyhound buses and sent them to California with instructions to call 911 once they got to San Francisco. I'm pretty sure a lot of New York's gentrification has led to their drops in violent crime, but you're just really moving the statistics around. And then, of course, you know, New York has all kinds of issues of its own with its police department, which we've talked about tonight, and, you know, many other stories in regards to that. You're not going to be able to gentrify the part of Kansas City or the part of St. Louis, the parts of these towns that suffer from these violent crimes. It's not going to be possible because you don't have the same real estate situation here in Kansas City as takes place in New York City. But more policing, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but the idea is that the police respond to crimes, and unless we are going to put police officers on the street as deterrents, and literally on the street, not in cop cars, not in squad cars, but as foot patrols on the streets, as deterrents all over the metro, again, I don't think we're going to see a deterrent. And even that is not addressing the fundamental issues here, which are of economics. Didn't start to have these huge spikes in violent crime in this country until deindustrialization started. And those two events are inextricably linked together. It's 1:35 in the morning right here on 90.1 FM. This is the Paragon Radio Program. I'm Benjamin, your host. Jake's in the studio. Jake's playing Minecraft or something like that. 816-931-5534. 931-KKFI is the telephone number. If you would like to talk on the radio in the middle of the night, you could do so at that phone number. We talk about whatever you want to talk about. We talk about brain-eating amoebas. We could talk about herpes-infected monkeys. We could talk about the growing Antarctic ice caps and fields of ice down there on the southern part of the third stone from the sun. We could talk about how Vladimir Putin is the ultimate cock blocker on the international stage. We could talk about inner city violence, if you'd like to. And the way to solve that, I mean, there's lots of possibilities and options for a conversation that we could have right now.
Obama's coming to town Friday. You live or work anywhere near the Ford Clay Como plant, expect your day to be ruined.
Unless you work at the Ford Clay Como plant, you're probably going to have a great day. Are they going to talk about the progress of the automotive industry?
Is there?
Well, why is Obama coming to town? Is he picking out a new Ford?
The beast broke down. They're fashioning up something for him. Yeah, it's about the automotive financial nonsense. Well, on the surface. He's probably going to head up to Warrensburg and check on his buddy. Kidding. Last time he was here, the Saudi guy got out of the pokey when they said he never would.
I'm pretty sure that guy's gone now, isn't he?
I don't know. Warrensburg's pretty appealing. I don't think he was finished with his flight training.
So there's lots of things we could talk about. We could talk about the fact that it's rained for the first time in seemingly 6 months in Kansas City, which is nice. It'll flush out the sewers a little bit.
Or clog them up.
Something needs to be flushed out. Combined sewer system does get a bit of a smell to it from time to time. 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI, is the telephone number for you to call if you would like. Surprised there hasn't been a false flag. So I'm surprised that nobody has bombed a U.S. warship in the Mediterranean yet. This week. It was last week, but I guess it's the start of a new week, so that becomes very possible as we look forward to what's coming up.
They like to wait till Tuesday.
You think Tuesday will be a good day?
Well, it's the Tiwas is the god of the sky. They usually rain freedom down on non-freedom loving people on Tuesdays.
We could listen to a little Greg Palast if you'd like. That's not Greg Palast.
So he picked up some drumsticks?
This is Lou Gradowski of WeAreChange.org, and I'm here with Greg Palast of GregPalast.com, investigative journalist who recently uncovered a memo that's really going to shake up the seat of the next Federal Reserve chairman. Greg, can you tell us what you found?
Pretty nasty stuff. A memo written to Larry Summers, who's Obama's choice or leading choice for head of the Federal Reserve Board to replace Ben Bernanke. In this memo, it references Summers having a series of secret, illegal meetings with the heads of the CEOs of the big five banks in America, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Citibank. In this memo, it's clear that Summers is having secret and therefore illegal meetings with bankers to determine what United States economic policy should be worldwide. And basically, it's like the mob meeting with the police chief and deciding, you know, what the police rules ought to be.
Wow. I mean, that's just incredible. How were you able to get your hands on this memo, and were you able to verify it?
How I got my hands on the memo, a little birdie came by and dropped it on me. And I don't remember his name or her.
I don't know now.
And either do I. Given what's happened to other journalists, I have to be careful about this. It is a confidential diplomatic message from within the State Department and Treasury Department. So I'm not supposed to have it, needless to say. How did I verify it? Several ways. One, it had the private phone numbers of these top bankers. So I called one. But I had to say who I was under BBC rules. It wasn't Larry Summers, so it was Click. But I actually got to the chief, the chairman of the board of Citibank. No secretaries, nothing. So it was legit inside numbers. Yeah. Second, I flew to Geneva, Switzerland, and met with the head of the World Trade Organization, because the core part of this memo was how to force other nations to join America in jumping off the bank deregulation cliff. This was serious stuff. The international financial system completely collapsed, and this memo was at the heart of it. Wow. And so I met with the head of the WTO, and he says, Pascal Amy, oh, Monsieur Palast, we don't have evil cabals of bankers determining our policy here at the WTO. And then I showed him the memo. He says, oh, well, you know, so I confirmed it there. Then I, one of the nations, in addition to the United States, which fell to its knees, the rest of the planet, including, for example, Ecuador, which was forced to accept toxic assets, toxic derivatives. In other words, if they want to sell us our bananas, their goods, they had to accept our bads, our derivatives, and all this financial junk, which ultimately destroyed the economy of Ecuador. So because I had these documents, I flew to Quito, Ecuador, met with the president, Rafael Correa, who confirmed that, yeah, they did muscle him, that this is the real thing. He didn't know about that memo. He knew the effect of the memo and what Summers did to him and his nation. And so he had suspected that there was such a plan, and so this confirmed it. I then also spoke with a member of Bill Clinton's cabinet who was with Summers. That is Joe Stiglitz, who later won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And he said he would sit in cabinet meetings with Larry Summers, and Summers would turn to Robert Rubin, then Secretary of the Treasury before Summers. Summers would turn to Rubin and say, whenever a policy matter came up, well, what would Goldman think of this? Well, how would Goldman feel about that? And finally, Stiglitz said, you know, we're in the West Wing, you know. You know, President Bartlett doesn't talk like this. I mean, what do we care what Goldman thinks? Don't you think that's inappropriate? Shouldn't it be what's best for the American people? And they looked at him like he was, you know, just fell off a watermelon truck. So the result was that they dumped Stiglitz out of the cabinet. Larry Summers was raised to Secretary of Treasury under Clinton and then became economics czar under Obama. At the demand of the big banks, including Robert Rubin of Citibank and Goldman Sachs. And so what we see here with the probable appointment of Larry Summers as head of the Federal Reserve Board is the bankers choosing their boy. It's not that Obama's choosing Summers. Summers is choosing Obama. The banks have chosen Summers for Obama. That's what we're seeing. And if you look at this memo, it's a conspiracy nuts wet dream because, you know, people have said, oh, the bankers and the Treasury guys all get together in this evil cabal to determine our, in a secret room and they come up with the new laws and they're the ones that tore apart financial regulations. And sure enough, there's the actual memo, the phone numbers, the meeting notes. Wow. And I have several other documents too, by the way. But, you know, to me, Stiglitz saying, yeah, this is the type of thing that they would do. They would sit there and say, what would Goldman think? They didn't take a chance. They would call up Goldman and ask.
So this is pure evidence of collusion, insider trading, of the largest companies coming together with the government and buying off the government for their own personal benefit and against the benefit of everybody else. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, the effect of this is horrific, which is that the decriminalizing of the banking system led to massive, massive unemployment in the United States, destruction in Europe still being felt. Part of this deal in this memo was to allow the trade in foreign currency derivatives. This is what sank the Greek government. You have 27% unemployment there. The world has fallen on its face and never recovered, and that's a great extent because of Larry Summers playing secret games with the banks. And like I say, you can't do that. They could. By the way, the Secretary of the Treasury can meet with any damn banker they want. The thing is, they can't do it in secret. They can't have secret phone calls without telling us that they've done it and its purpose. And because these guys are making billions off this inside information and off the deals that allowed them to make billions at our expense. Look, it's not a victimless crime. Billionaire bankers are not victimless criminals. Believe me.
Now, if we had a just legal system, what would be the larger implications of this memo?
Well, number one, if we had a just system, instead of rewarding Larry Summers with the position of head of the Federal Reserve Board, he would be banned from government positions forever. He violated the rules of open government. We have laws in the United States. We were supposed to be a nation of laws. I just heard the President of the United States talk about, you know, international law and the rule of law. And I agree with him. It's very important. So then how come he's appointing a lawbreaker as head of the Federal Reserve Board? This is very serious stuff. We have open government for a reason. They're not supposed to be secret. The other thing is that, yeah, I understand these banks made billions off these deals. They should divulge up that money that they got from the inside deals that they got through Larry Summers. That's our money. You have to understand that one of the things that Goldman Sachs did was bet heavily on the collapse of the U.S. mortgage market. They made $4 billion for themselves and their clients. And they not only bet on the collapse of the mortgage market, they made it collapse, and that was part of the deregulation game directed by Larry Summers. And then, by the way, they went out and hired him, paid him. Larry Summers is worth about $37 million. He's been paid millions and millions of dollars by the banks he was supposedly policing. I mean, imagine a police chief going to work for the mob. This is, you know, this is the type of stuff that makes people feel ill about government. And it, you know, this is what Obama has decided to give us as head of the Federal Reserve Board.
I don't think people realize that this isn't over. I mean, we had this terrible financial crisis that almost took down the whole financial system 5 years ago. But yet their government wants them to think that, oh, it's all been papered over, it's all been fixed, everything's hunky-dory.
It's looting the economy for their own personal benefit and creating a crisis. The government here in Northern Ireland has decided to...
Recording of a presentation I made shortly after the publication of my book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. And so here it is, as recorded live in Los Angeles, California, on November 18, 1994. My presentation on the Federal Reserve, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Thank you, Ernie, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Although, Ernie, I have to tell you, I think I like the short introduction better. I guess there was a lot of traffic out there tonight, so we're getting started quite late. So I think I'll dispense with the usual jokes and all the preliminary remarks and jump right into the topic. And to try and give it some kind of historical perspective, I'd like to go back to the first century BC, to a tiny kingdom called Phrygia. It was in Phrygia that there was a philosopher by the name of Epictetus. And it was Epictetus who said, appearances are of four kinds. Things either are as they appear to be, or they neither are nor appear to be, or they are but do not appear to be, or they are not and yet appear to be. There'll be a quiz on this. When I read that statement, I was sure that if Epictetus were alive today, he probably would be a Harvard professor of banking and economics. Because doesn't that sound like the kind of explanations that we get when you read through the Federal Reserve bulletins trying to tell you what the money aggregates are and that kind of thing? See, what Epictetus did was he took a relatively simple concept, but by the time he was through explaining it, we didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And this is so commonly done today by the experts. Nevertheless, I thought that his statement was pretty good because it provided us with a track to run on, kind of a theme for this presentation. Because, you know, if there's anything in the world that is an appearance which is deceiving, it is the Federal Reserve System. In fact, it is one of those appearances of the fourth kind, which I'm sure you all remember, for those appearances which are not and yet appear to be. So I'd like to use that as my theme for this topic and come back to it now and then during the progress of this presentation, if I remember to do that, and use it as a punctuation point here and there and as a reminder of one of the most important aspects about the Federal Reserve System that there is to comprehend, and that is that there are a lot of deceptive appearances going on here. I think the best place to begin our story is with the creation of the Federal Reserve System itself. In fact, that takes us right to the reason for the title of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. For those of you who are not yet familiar with the background of this story, you should know that Jekyll Island is a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia, and it was on that island in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was conceived, at a highly secret meeting that took place there. When things are done in secret, there's usually something to hide. And so I'd like to tell you that story and document it so that we can find out, first of all, that there was a meeting, that the Federal Reserve was indeed created there, that indeed there was a great deal of secrecy, and then we'll ask the question, why the secrecy? In 1910, Jekyll Island was completely owned by a small group of millionaires from New York. People such as J.P. Morgan, William Rockefeller, and their associates. This is where their families came to spend the winter months. It was a resort island. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. And on the island, there was a magnificent clubhouse, which was the center of their social activities. You can visit that clubhouse today, as a matter of fact. The island has since been purchased by the state of Georgia, and the clubhouse has been fully restored. It's a beautiful thing. And if you take the tour, you can walk down the corridor there, and there will be a room, and on the door to that room is a brass plaque, and it says, "The Federal Reserve System was created in this room." So there's no secret about this part of it. It's a matter of public record. So this is how that story came to pass. It was November of that year, 1910, when Senator Nelson Aldridge sent his private railroad car to the New Jersey Railroad Station late in the evening. And there it was in readiness for the arrival of himself and six other men who were told to come under conditions of extreme secrecy. For example, they were told to come one at a time, not to dine with each other on the night of their departure. They were told to avoid arriving at the same time if they could. If they should happen to show up at the same time, they were instructed to pretend not to even know each other. They had to avoid newspaper reporters because they were well-known people, and newspaper reporters often frequented the railroad station. Had they been seen, questions would have been asked, especially if several of them had been seen together. One of the men carried a shotgun in a big black case, so that if he had been asked where he was going, he was prepared to say that he was going on a duck hunting trip. The interesting thing about that is that we find out from his biography that this man never fired a gun in his life. He didn't even own one. He borrowed that shotgun just for the purpose of deception and camouflage. Even after they got on board this private railroad car, this pattern continued. They were instructed to use their first names only, to avoid last names. And a couple of them even abandoned their first names and chose code names. The reason for that was so that the servants on board the train would not know who these men were, because they were afraid if the servants had talked about it, word had leaked out in that fashion, then the purpose of the meeting could have been defeated. So absolute secrecy was essential all the way up and down the line. The private railroad car traveled for two nights and a day on a 1,000-mile journey to the south. And when they awoke the second morning, the car was on the siding at Brunswick, Georgia. There they took a ferry boat across the Inland Strait to Jekyll Island, then to the clubhouse. And for the next 9 days, they sat around a table and they hammered out all of the important details of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. When they were done, they went back to New York. And for quite a few years after that, they denied that such a meeting ever took place. It wasn't until after the Federal Reserve System was firmly established that only then did they begin to talk openly about their meeting and what they accomplished there. Several of them wrote books on it. One of them wrote a magazine article, and they gave interviews to newspaper reporters. And so now, many years later, it's possible for us to go back to the public record and discover in minute detail exactly what happened on Jekyll Island in 1910. Now, who were these seven men? The first one I've already mentioned, Senator Nelson Aldridge. He was the fellow that owned the private railroad car. He was the Republican whip in the Senate. He was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was that special committee of Congress created to make a recommendation for legislative reform, banking reform, they called it. They wanted to reform banking in America because the American people were very concerned over the concentration of financial power into the hands of a small group of banks and investment firms in New York on Wall Street. That is what they called the money trust. That was a popular phrase. In fact, quite a few politicians had been successfully elected to office on their campaign promise to break the grip of the money trust. And that was one of the primary purposes of the National Monetary Commission, of which Senator Aldridge was chairman. He was also a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., which means, of course, that eventually he became the grandfather of Nelson Rockefeller, our former vice president. Remember, his full name was Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, so he derived his middle name from his famous grandfather. The second man at the meeting was Abraham Piatt Andrew, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Later, he became a congressman, and throughout his career, he was very important in banking circles. The third man there was Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, the largest and most powerful of all the banks in America. Representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. Henry Davison was there. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there, president of the First National Bank of New York, another one of the giants. Also, there was Benjamin Strong, head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And incidentally, Benjamin Strong, 3 years later, when the Federal Reserve Act was finally passed, he became the first head of the Federal Reserve System. And finally, last but certainly not least, Paul Warburg was there, probably the most important man because of his knowledge of banking in Europe. Warburg was born in Germany, eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company. But he was also a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And throughout his whole banking career, he maintained close business liaison with his brother, Max Warburg, who was head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the world. But those are the seven men on Jekyll Island. And as in